from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, voters got to see some more substantive differences between the Democratic presidential candidates last night from their views on the value of age and experience and the role of money in politics.
Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
We break down last night's Democratic presidential debate and get your reactions after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. California played host to last night's Democratic presidential debate in Los Angeles from PBS and Politico. And while some Golden State issues came up, they didn't in the ways you might expect, like Napa's wine caves. But the smaller number of candidates on the debate stage did allow for some substantive exchanges and for voters to see some of the candidates in new ways.
I know what you're thinking, America. How am I still on this stage with them?
Joining me to break it all down is Carla Marinucci. She is Politico's California Playbook reporter and former political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And Scott Schaefer is also with us. He's senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and, of course, co-host of Political Breakdown. And Scott Schaefer, I just want to start with you. Just remind us how last night's debate was different from all the others we've seen so far.
Well, it was the first one in California. And for those of us who were hoping that perhaps more California issues would come up, we were a little disappointed. But obviously the size of the debate stage, there were just seven candidates, which allowed for a little more in-depth, a little more nuanced kinds of conversations on issues ranging from climate change to international diplomacy and a lot of other things. And obviously, you know, the preseason is just about over. We're getting close now to the Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire. And so you're beginning to see the sharper edges coming out. Certainly we saw that between Senator Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, as well as with Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. And so I think, you know, it's getting more serious. And the fact that it's narrowed down enables viewers and listeners to get a better sense of who these candidates are, what their differences are. But, you know, the fundamental questions, I think, remain even after last night. And it's this debate between who is most electable? Should it be somebody who is going to appeal to moderates and independents and maybe some Republicans? Or is it somebody who's going to really mobilize new voters, younger voters, voters of color? And I think that question is still very much up in the air.
Well, you mentioned how two candidates, at least, but several others also did go after Pete Buttigieg. And so just remind us what his position is in the polling right now, and especially as we go into Iowa.
Well, it's really a very bifurcated situation for Pete Buttigieg, because he is very much on the rise in Iowa. There are several polls that show him first, right bunched up at the top with Senator Warren and also Senator Sanders. Biden has not really been in the lead in either Iowa or New Hampshire the way he is nationally, and that's the problem for Pete Buttigieg. He's doing quite well in both Iowa and New Hampshire, but then he hits this wall, largely because he isn't as well known. He hasn't campaigned as much in these other states, but also largely because he just is doing so poorly among voters of color. And that's really been Biden's firewall, especially in places like South Carolina, where the African-American community is with him solidly. And so Buttigieg is clearly a threat to that middle lane. And I think that's one reason you're seeing Amy Klobuchar go after him more intensely, as she did last night, because she really is vying for some of those same voters who want maybe somebody from the Midwest, somebody who can appeal to voters outside the coastal elites, as they like to say. And so he's definitely a rising threat. And last night was the first time he was really, really, really in the hot seat.
And before we get into the substance of how he was addressed by some of the other candidates, Carla Marinucci, I would love to get your just sort of top of the line reaction to who you thought did really well last night.
Yeah, I was down here in Los Angeles and kind of to watch the reaction on the scene. I think Amy Klobuchar did very well. I would sort of pronounce her the winner of this debate in the sense of she just took charge in a folksy but sort of very substantive way and really managed to make her case. And we saw her and Pete Buttigieg going after it. I think that last night's debate was really kind of a contest for the moderate middle lane of the Democratic Party when you saw Klobuchar going after Buttigieg, and Biden, I thought, did very well. I think he has probably the best debate of his yet. He was also somebody who talked about experience, talked about that middle lane, talked about some of the problems with Medicare for All, and challenged Bernie Sanders on that and Warren. And I think those three in the middle, Biden, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar, may have come out on top last night. We're probably the winners in the debate.
And we do actually have some tape of an exchange between Buttigieg and Klobuchar, and I think this is mainly Klobuchar, but she was basically going after Buttigieg around the question of experience.
We should have someone heading up this ticket that has actually won and been able to show that they can gather the support that you talk about of moderate Republicans and independents, as well as a fired up Democratic base. And not just done it once, I have done it three times. I think winning matters. I think a track record of getting things done matters. And I also think showing our party that we can actually bring people with us, have a wider tent, have a bigger coalition, and yes, longer coattails, that matters.
Carla Marinucci, even though she is trying to get that sort of middle lane and get those voters, do you think she has to walk kind of a fine line of being hard on Buttigieg but not too hard in case she wants to pick up his supporters?
Well, you know, I think she went at his most vulnerable, you know, his Achilles heel. She has won three statewide elections in Minnesota, and she went after him as kind of a, quote, local official. I mean, she also nailed him for attacking 100 years of experience on that last November debate stage. He did mention that. He said 100 years of experience looking around. Where has it gotten us? And she reminded him of all the accomplishments of the other legislators on stage. And she asked him to, you know, respect our experience when you look at how you evaluate somebody. She has made the case and used that moment to make the case that in winning in Minnesota, as she has, she may be in a stronger position to go after Donald Trump, to beat Donald Trump on the ground there. And she also, you know, reminded him he lost a statewide election in his state. And that is no small thing. I mean, this has been, I think, Democratic voters' biggest concern, one of the biggest concerns about Buttigieg. Can he beat Donald Trump? He is a small town mayor, a mayor whose town is smaller than Antioch, California. I mean, that alone gives people pause. And even those who support LGBT causes are concerned, will a gay married man be able to cross that bridge and appeal to voters on a wide scale in America when it comes to going head to head with Donald Trump? So Klobuchar went right to that, and in doing so, really tried to track and dominate that that moderate lane. And I think she did a pretty good job. He was prepared on both counts, I have to say, though, Mima, when it came to both Warren and Klobuchar. And I think he acquitted himself very well in those attacks.
Yeah, he did have that one line, too, with Klobuchar when he said, you know, try winning as a gay mayor in Mike Pence's Indiana.
A gay dude, I think he said. You know, I think, Mina, there's also an echo of 2008 a little bit here with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, where Hillary Clinton had all this experience, you know, as first lady, as a senator, and, you know, very well qualified in a lot of ways. And in 2016 as well versus Trump. And I remember Bill Clinton talking about Barack Obama as a, you know, it's a big fairy tale that this guy is qualified, you know, to be president of the United States. And so, you know, but voters often don't really care about those things so much. I'm not saying that experience doesn't matter, and I'm not saying that Amy Klobuchar didn't make a very compelling case for experience and winning in a purple state, purple-ish state like Minnesota. But I think voters, you know, oftentimes, and in this particular election, are really looking for electability. They're looking, and always likability, too. Like, who is it that they, you know, it's that old question, who do you want to have a beer with? And that's why the retail politics in Iowa and New Hampshire are so important.
Well, let me invite the listeners to join the conversation now, just because I know Carla Marinucci, you need to leave us at the break, and I want to make sure our listeners have a chance to ask you questions if they'd like to. The number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, and also you can post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And we already got a comment from Joe, who writes, we should stop talking about the debate in terms of performance and personality and only talk about the issues. Well, one of the issues that did come up was this question of the role of money in politics. And it was punctuated very interestingly with a reference to wine caves. I want to play a little bit of that, if I could. I believe we do have a cut. And actually, I'm getting a signal from our producers that they may need a moment to grab that if they can. So we will wait until I get the go-ahead that we have it. But just describe that exchange for us, Carla Marinucci.
Well, this is where, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren really sort of unleashed the meme of the night when she went after him, talking about that most of the people on stage were going from coast to coast, courting rich people who could write hefty checks. And that's where she went right to Buttigieg and derided this fundraiser held in Napa, which she said called a wine cave full of crystals and serving $900 a bottle of wine. She said that Democrats, or her campaign, had made a decision long ago that, quote, rich people in smoke-filled rooms would not pick the next president of the United States. And she said billionaires in wine caves should not be part of that. Buttigieg was completely ready for that attack and basically said he's the only candidate on the stage who is not a millionaire or a billionaire. And going right back to Warren, said, Senator, your net worth is 100 times mine. He also made the case that, look, if Democrats are going to beat Donald Trump, they have got to have the resources to do it, and that means raising money. And he said he is not going to turn down checks from people who want to support the Democratic cause, and that is the only way to go head-to-head with the Republicans, who are raising millions and millions of dollars. So it was an argument that was interesting to watch. It was one of the liveliest things of the night. Whether voters out there are going to be concerned about raising money in wine caves, this is going to be the question.
Yes. You know, I do have a little bit now. The cut is ready. A Buttigieg responding to Elizabeth Warren. And I...
President of the United...
You know, according to Forbes magazine, I am literally the only person on this stage who's not a millionaire or a billionaire. So if this is important, this is the problem with issuing purity tests you cannot yourself pass.
And that was Pete Buttigieg responding to Elizabeth Warren's attack. Now, first of all, I think you raise an interesting question, Carla Marinucci, about whether or not voters are going to care about wine caves. And I got to be honest, Scott, I mean, for those of us who have been to wine caves, like, they are not these, like, totally exclusive, inaccessible places that you can't go
to. No, and as Gavin Newsom said, you know, there are a lot of Democrats, and probably including him, that have been to that wine cave to do fundraisers.
I mean,
that
it's a Hall Winery in Napa, actually. Yeah. And I mean, they do tastings there. It's a very...
I think it's maybe a little tougher to stick on a guy like Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, which, as Carla points out, is about the size of Antioch, you know, that he's schmoozing with rich people. I mean, he doesn't come off. He's not a Mike Bloomberg. He's not even a Joe Biden, you know, who is used to hobnobbing with fancy people. So I think, you know, as the subject of that attack, it might be might stick a little bit less on a Buttigieg than it would on somebody else.
But he has been raising money, in California in the last week in some very Tony places. Look, Silicon Valley, the royalty of Silicon Valley turned out earlier this week. Some of the family members of Sergey Brin, Sheryl Sandberg, Reed Hastings of Netflix. You know, yeah, these are billionaires. And Buttigieg's point was, you know, that deal with it. We've got to raise money from people like this if Democrats are going to win. I think the, as Scott said, Gavin Newsom, we did catch him in the spin room. He laughed off the wine caves issue. He's already getting attacked on Twitter. He's getting attacked on Twitter for that, saying this is where Democrats are going. It could be an issue, but I think the issue of money is the one that Buttigieg wanted to raise, and I think he has a point when it comes to how are Democrats going to get the checks. Elizabeth Warren has also, he pointed out, raised money in her own Senate campaign and raises money in fundraisers for the Democratic National Committee, which she has to do as a candidate. She doesn't do it in her own campaign, and she's been raising money with smaller dollar donations for her presidential race. But the fact is, has she been somebody who has completely eschewed big fundraisers? No, she has not.
Well, Kevin in Santa Rosa wants to weigh in on Buttigieg. And Kevin, join us.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. So I live in Santa Rosa, and we went through the Tubbs fire, and our mayor at the time, Chris Corsi, dealt with state and federal dollars magnificently. We're a town of about 175,000 people. That's 75,000 larger than South Bend. And I think by no stretch of the imagination would anyone in Santa Rosa think that our mayor, who did so much and we're so grateful for, would be qualified to be the president of the United States.
Well, thanks.
Thank you. I'll take my comment off here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly, a lot of people would agree with that. On the other hand, I think his argument is, look, I have different kinds of experience. I served in the military. I'm the only one up here who did. And he was a Rhodes Scholar. He has other experiences as an openly gay man. But, it would be the first time a mayor ever in the U.S. history that a sitting mayor has gotten elected president of the United States.
Well, Cameron tweets, if the electability of a gay married man is the limiting factor for a Democratic candidate, then I'm not sure this party deserves to win. And again, we're talking with Scott Schaefer, senior editor of KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And of course, you hear him on Political Breakdown. And Carla Marinucci is with us from Politico. She also does California's Playbook. And of course, she was with the San Francisco Chronicle for a long time as their political writer as well. I just want to bring in the Bay Area man on the stage, Tom Steyer, especially as we're talking about money and the role of money in politics. So tell me how you think he did, Carla Marinucci.
Well, I think Tom Steyer made the argument, and I think it's his strongest argument, that he was there on this issue of impeachment long before any of those other folks on the stage. With his Need to Impeach campaign, he's raised about, I think, 6 million signatures for this. He has been sort of a voice for all those folks who have supported impeachment. I think he was impassioned last night. He delivered his message well, but he has a very big problem right now, and that is Michael Bloomberg, somebody who wasn't on the stage last night, another very rich guy who has dropped into this race and who is sort of taking up the Tom Steyer lane in the sense of climate change, gun safety issues, some of the very same issues that Tom Steyer has pushed. Whether Steyer is going to qualify for the next debate, we're going to see the bar is higher for that. It doesn't seem like, traction-wise, he has gotten that much out of these debates. And Bloomberg is able, with his money, to just bigfoot him all over the place when it comes to ads that are hitting California down here in Los Angeles. I'm seeing Bloomberg ads on the top of Ubers, mobile ads. I mean, that is big, way bigger money than Tom Steyer has. So, Steyer makes his case, but I'm not sure in the polls it has helped him much. Who knows where it's going to go? He insists and has to me that he's going to be one of the last men standing on the stage when it comes to November. And we'll see. But right now, it looks like a challenge.
Yeah. Well, Steyer is trying to push his hedge fund manager experiences to say that he would be very strong on the economy.
I do think he made a pretty compelling case. Not only was he out in front on impeachment, he has been consistently talking about climate change and, again, mentioned that last night.
Yes, he was strong on it last night.
Yeah, he was strong, and I think he made a very compelling case for using climate change as a way to unite the country fighting climate change and also to reinvigorate all kinds of new jobs, in that clean energy field for people who now work in other industries, whether it's coal or, other parts of the fossil fuel industry. I think that is a contribution that he made. Just coming back to the issue of money in politics, I mean, I don't think any people who care about issues like gun control, tobacco, say Juul, gun control, soda taxes. Mike Bloomberg gave lots and lots of money to local campaigns to advocate on behalf of the issues that Democrats care about. And so, you know, in that case, that is money in politics, and it's coming from a billionaire. And so I do think that Pete Buttigieg makes a good point when he says, you know, these purity tests are sometimes difficult to live up to. And I would also make the case that until we have either an amendment of some kind, a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, or public financing of campaigns, there's always going to be money in politics, no matter who the president is, because that's what industries and interest groups do. They lobby Congress, they lobby legislators, and until you take money completely out of the system, which is really very unlikely to happen, you're always going to have that as an issue. And you can claim that you're holier than thou, but I think the reality is a little different.
Though I thought Bernie Sanders had a strong moment when he brought up the number of billionaires that were supporting both Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg. Let me see if I can
I think
get...
it was Biden. Biden and Buttigieg.
Oh, Biden. That's right. Yeah. Biden and Buttigieg. Let me bring in Ed in Hayward now. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I'm glad you pulled me up now. I brought up that you are all experienced political analysts, and you remember that under Nixon, he said, run to the extreme in the primary. So did Carville, told him. Run to the extreme in the primary. And then in the general, run to the center. And you opened this presentation with the idea that the centrists were the big winners of this debate. Mm. You said Klobuchar and Buttigieg were more moderate and mainline and were the winners. And this kind of says something about where the party is going. And your very most recent little piece on this about Bloomberg. Who is the extreme of expansive government of the nanny state is not doing as well, but pretty much defines who that party is.
Well, Ed, I think you're referring to what Carla Marinucci said about how she felt the candidates did last night. Carla, do you want to respond to Ed?
Well, I think this I mean, Elizabeth Warren's, challenge in recent days has been, and she's lost traction, I think, because of her stance on the so-called billionaires tax, where she's talking about a few cents on the dollar after, $50 million in income. A lot of the polls are showing, and you're hearing it from folks on Wall Street who are saying, look, I don't like Donald Trump, but if it's Elizabeth Warren who's the nominee, I might have to think twice. She's getting some blowback on some of her positions, and she's moderated her position on her health care plan. I think coming to the middle, that's where it's, I think some of the polls are showing that Democratic voters, particularly in states like Iowa, New Hampshire, may be on a more moderate path. I think maybe watching Bernie Sanders is interesting because he still has maintained that passionate support from the far left. But this is where it's going to come down to, I think, meaning when we talk about the drama that's ahead in some of these early primary states. And in California, this is where also, Bernie Sanders has been strong, but Joe Biden has been leading the pack here all the way. And Buttigieg has made, advances here in his polling. So it's going to be interesting to watch if the moderate lane, gains strength as we go forward.
Well, Olivia tweets, Elizabeth Warren disappointed me with her falling for political bait and not directly answering questions and dismissing facts. Bernie Sanders did the best. Rarely do I hear a politician say I was wrong and then name a woman who was right. Carla Marinucci, Politico's California Playbook reporter, Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. They're with us to break down last night's debate in Los Angeles. And you, our listeners, are with us as well. 866-733-6786 is the number to call to register your opinion or tweet us, post your comments on Facebook, or email us at forum@kqed.org. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Last night was the final Democratic presidential primary debate of 2019, and issues of big money, donors, gender, and age were at the forefront. And we're talking with Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And we're joined now by Jennifer Medina. She's national political correspondent covering the 2020 presidential campaign for The New York Times. Hello to you, Jennifer Medina.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. And you, our listeners, are with us as well, giving us your thoughts on the candidates that impressed you, the issues that you were glad to see discussed, and issues, tell us which ones you wish were discussed. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Jennifer Medina, I want to go to you. I had asked the guests earlier about who they felt like really stood out, and they mentioned several of the moderate candidates. Is there anybody that you would, besides Klobuchar and Buttigieg and Biden, anybody that really jumped out at you?
I think with seven people on the stage, they all had a chance to jump out, and I would probably add my voice to Klobuchar really sort of asserting herself and Buttigieg being the recipient of a lot of attacks there. I think Senator Sanders and Senator Warren really tried to make their voices heard, and I think you saw Vice President Biden sort of recede to the background in a lot of ways, which might have been good for him.
And yet, of course, we get an email from Andrew Yang's campaign saying he won last night. Tell us a little bit about Andrew Yang. I know that you looked at his candidacy a little more closely, specifically how Asian Americans are reacting to him.
Yeah, Andrew Yang had a really interesting position last night because he was the only person of color on stage at a time when the Democratic Party has really been debating the role of race and talking about diversity and particularly talking about Black and Latino voters. And so you saw last night, Andrew Yang is the one non-white person on there and the first person to be asked about race on the debate stage. And what's interesting about Yang is that he really has not made race the center of his campaign, but he sort of tried to figure out how to deal with others making it a central issue in his campaign. And most of the way he has dealt with it is by kind of making jokes often. And you saw the opposite of that last night. He really tried to take the question and use it as a chance to talk about Black voters and African-American issues.
Yeah, and I will play a little bit of how he responded to that question about being the only candidate of color on stage.
It's both an honor and disappointment to be the lone candidate of color on the stage tonight. I miss Kamala. I miss Corey, though I think Corey will be back.
And so, you know, first, before we get into a little more about how folks are responding to him as a candidate, I am curious to get your thoughts on why you think we're at the point where there is only one candidate of color making the debate stage, Jennifer Medina.
Well, it's mostly really simple in that it's all about polls at this point. Both Cory Booker and, well, Kamala Harris qualified and decided to drop out, but both Cory Booker and Julian Castro had enough donors to make the stage, but hadn't been polling high enough to make the stage. And so one of the really interesting things here is there's a lot of complaints. There's a lot of consternation about, oh, candidates of color aren't on stage, but polls show those candidates are not really winning voters right now, at least according to the polls that we're seeing.
There was an NPR interview recently where one of the guests, when asked this question, said that voters are actually very scared about losing to Donald Trump, and that even voters of color for this reason may be supporting Biden because it's all about who can win, who can beat Trump. Do you think that's true?
I think the conversation has absolutely been around electability, and who gets to define what electability is a really interesting question. But the conventional wisdom, both among white voters and among voters of color, certainly seems to be that a white person, or maybe specifically Joe Biden, has the most electable, has the chance of being the most electable, and that a Black or Latino candidate does not. It's a really interesting and really fraught question because sort of baked into that is, well, why do we think Black and Latino candidates aren't electable?
Well, let me go to Carl in Yuba City. Hi, Carl.
Hello, how's it going?
Well, what do you want to say?
Oh, so I had a commentary on exactly what you guys are talking about, the Black and Latino voters. I believe that we've got to kind of have these Democrats dig in a little bit more when they're talking about what they're actually going to do for the Black and Latinos. Myself, I'm African-American. My wife's Latino. And when we hear the debates and we hear exactly what they're talking about, we're not really getting in depth on reparations and exactly help. We heard a little bit about HBCUs and crediting some of that stuff, but we want to hear why should the black voter stick with Democrats? Why should we not look at a Republican, the Republican Party? Why should we stay in this environment with the Democratic Party and continue to help them? While what are they going to do day one? I heard day one they're going to help reparations with, you know, some of the Latino kids that were separated at the border. What are we going to do for the African American community?
Do you hear any candidate speaking to that in terms of issues, Carl?
When I hear them speaking of that, I hear them speaking of what currently is happening, and taking a look is what the terminology that they use. They're not quite digging in on what they're going to do day one. What are they going to do to maintain the black vote? That's what I want to hear. I want to hear, why should I myself, as a 25-year-old black male, vote for any of the Democratic Party?
Carl, thanks. Do you think Scott Schaefer Yang's point about we have to stop being obsessed over impeachment and start really digging in and solving the problems is resonating? I mean, it was one of the major differences between Yang and every other candidate on the impeachment question that started.
I think that impeachment was the first question asked about last night. And I clearly, all these candidates who have been out campaigning for months and months and months, they're not hearing about impeachment from voters. And so I think all of them really would like to move on to the other issues that voters do care about, whether it's the economy or health care, education, public schools, housing. I think the media is obsessed with this issue, but the candidates and the voters really would like to talk about something else. And if I could just get back to the caller, too. Talking a moment ago about African-American voters.
Carl,
it's interesting. There's a real generational divide, I think, in the African-American community, where you have older black voters who are really loyal to Joe Biden, in part, not entirely, but in part because of his close relationship with Barack Obama. And then you have younger African-American voters. And we saw this in 2016 as well, where there was a lot of dissatisfaction among younger black voters with Hillary Clinton, and they were more supportive of Bernie Sanders. And Latino voters also are the biggest share of them going to Bernie Sanders. They're not going to Julian Castro. Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, the two of the African-American candidates in the race, also not attracting a lot of black voters. And so I do think that voters of color in some ways feel most under threat, most attacked by Donald Trump and his policies. And I think they, perhaps more than anyone, are focused on getting a nominee who can defeat Donald Trump, whether it's a white male or a person of color.
Though all of this said with the giant caveat that it's very hard to predict because, you know, voters of color are in no way a monolith.
Of course.
Mary writes, I'm so disappointed that there was no mention of gun violence. There is a generation of young people, new voters and future voters, who've grown up with active shooter drills in their schools and for whom gun violence is a paramount issue. Gabriel in Oakland join us. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi there. I wanted to actually follow up on Paul's comments. I'm a first-gen Latinx female voter, and I think that, you know, it's frustrating, you know, as a millennial and a first-generation voter, that it's none of the comments were really talked about during the debate, which is, again, the economy, student debt. You know, I'm a millennial, so we have baby boomers who are retiring. And, you know, as a millennial, I'm going to be, you know, there's no housing, there's no benefit of the economy that I've gained. All I have is student debt. You know, my vote was going to go to Sanders, but it's like, you know, Beto O'Rourke was going to be my vote because I felt like he was standing for a lot of the issues that mattered to me. And so I think that it's hard when I'm kind of just not even looking into the debates as much. I'm not paying attention to the news because I feel that there's this trickle down thing that's happening of a loss of, you know, hope in our democratic system, where, you know, the president can go ahead and, you know, have his personal lawyer be involved in Ukraine. But where is the it just feels like frustrating as, you know, a voter. It's like, does my vote even really make a difference? We're talking about millionaires and who has that money. And I'm kind of just tired out, to be honest. And Yeah,
Gabrielle, you raised a lot of issues there in terms of what you also would want to hear the candidates talking about. And Jennifer Medina, I heard Gabrielle say housing. I mean, there were quite a few comments about how the moderators didn't ask a single question on housing when they're doing this debate in the state of California, which is dealing with a housing crisis.
you've really not seen housing or homelessness, for that matter, become a big issue in any of these debates. And it seemed like that with the debate being in California, that might have been a perfect time. We didn't see California issues specifically come up very much at all. And that's been the case in most of these debates. They've tended to stay on national issues, nothing specifically about the place where they are taking, where they are being held. But housing was sort of one of the big elephants in the room. After the debate ended, a lot of people I was talking to who are local officials in California were really disappointed in that.
Yes.
It almost makes you wonder, like, what's Scott the point Schaefer. Of having these debates all over the country? You know, the debate last night could have been anywhere.
Absolutely.
You know, you'd think that the moderators would have wanted to at least ask a question or two that really spoke to the audience and the people who live in California, but they really didn't.
One of the ways that California did come up was in a question from Politico's Tim Alberta about paradise and about, you know, how to deal with climate change and the issues that helped propel the fire in paradise. And you know, it's a kind of a reality that we are all just trying to address. Did you think anybody was strong in terms of their responses to that, Scott Schaefer?
Well, I think the Amy Klobuchar, if I'm not mistaken, was the one who said that she would spend federal money to help relocate people out of these sort of high-risk zones. I mean, this is an issue all over the country, whether you're living, you know, in the Mississippi Delta or along the coasts where sea level rise is going to be an issue. So, you know, it did. I think, obviously, Tom Steyer has made climate change a centerpiece of his campaign. Like I said, Klobuchar did well, but it was sort of in passing. I mean, I don't think it was really a focal point. Clearly all the candidates up there would, for example, rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. I think some of the differences around, say, nuclear power were fleshed out a little bit last night. But I think generally speaking, they're sort of on the same page when it comes to issues around clean energy, Paris Climate Accord, moving away from coal and fossil fuel.
Interestingly, Jennifer Medina, another way California came up was actually through Representative Barbara Lee. East Bay Representative Barbara Lee came up a few times, especially in relation to, you know, her vote against the Afghanistan war.
Yeah, she had a sort of surprise cameo, a couple of cameos there as sort of this ideal person to talk and to, as a way to talk about armed forces and use of force in international relations. It was really surprising and I thought really interesting.
Yeah, and also Barbara Lee was a person that tried to bring together the Bernie forces and the Hillary forces at the Democratic Convention in 2016. She held an event with Jesse Jackson. So she's really kind of a bridge builder. Interesting. I mean, something you never would have predicted going into last night, that of all people, she would be elevated as the one member of Congress from California who got a couple mentions.
Well, let me go to Rachel in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I wish all of these candidates could be president altogether because they would be the dream team. They all balance each other out. But obviously, it has to be one person. And my biggest concern is, what is the Republican Party brewing up right now in terms of attacks on the would-be candidate? And what are all the conservative radio show hosts brewing up, and what's Fox brewing up? How are they going to attack the candidate to be? Who of them is most susceptible to those attacks? Because I don't want that person. I'm not confident it would be Biden at this point. That would be a huge distraction from the issues. I can just imagine where.
Let me see what Scott Schaefer thinks.
I think that point is you just can hear in her voice the anxiety that so many Democrats feel about who can beat this guy. And no one really knows. I mean, electability is one of those nebulous things. I mean, they've all shown that they're tough. I think Elizabeth Warren, and there was, you know, Trump has used sort of the Pocahontas thing with her and her DNA testing on her Native American heritage. It's Sleepy Joe. It's all these things. I mean, Trump will do and say pretty much anything. thing. And so part of the question is really who has the mettle, who has the ability to counterpunch, who can take a punch and counterpunch, but also pivot in a way that makes Donald Trump look smaller and not play the game on his playing field. I think that the Democrats, if they try to win the election in 2020 by out-Trumping Trump, they're not going to win. They really need to shift the conversation in a different direction. And, you know, the voters will decide, you know, who that candidate is, obviously. I'm not sure it's clear right now who could best do that.
Well, Lou writes, kind of similar to what Rachel was saying, if one of the candidates is elected, can the others be part of their team or cabinet? They all have voices that I think need to be heard. Is that not a good strategy? David asks, would transitioning to ranked choice voting mean we wouldn't have to worry about electability anymore? I know you have a lot of opinions, Scott, on ranked choice yes. voting. Tom writes, the key point with the wine cave issue is that this fundraiser wasn't open to the press. Mayor Pete deflected by coming up with the purity test, but the concern isn't talking to millionaires. It's talking to them in secret. We're talking with Scott Schaefer, KQED senior editor for politics and government and co-host of Political Breakdown. We're also talking with Jennifer Medina, the national political correspondent covering the 2020 presidential campaign for the New York Times. Earlier, we had Carla Marinucci of Politico on with us, and she had to run and catch her plane. But we have you, our listeners. And this listener writes, really can't understand how you can talk about fundraising and not mention that Bernie Sanders raised more than anyone else without drawing from wealthy ruling class. Also, Sanders made his millions by writing a book, pretty much the least evil way to make money. Writing a book, you know, Jennifer Medina, that reminds me when that very interesting question came up about giving a gift to someone on the stage or asking forgiveness. Three of the men, I believe, touted their books to some extent, whereas the two women on stage said that they would ask forgiveness. Can you describe that moment a little bit, and what are some of the reactions that you're seeing to that?
That, to me, was one of the most fascinating moments of the night. The final question, as it often is, was sort of a softball question of saying, it's the season of giving and forgiving, and what would you give to these candidates on stage, or what would you ask for forgiveness for? And you saw an incredibly striking difference along gender lines. All the men had something to give, mostly their books.
Oh,
Klobuchar.
Sorry, Jennifer, you dropped out for just 1 second. Go ahead and repeat that last sentence you said.
The five men on stage all offered up their books or something along those lines, and the two women essentially apologized for taking passionate stances, essentially. And it was very, very striking how divided that was along gender lines.
Yes. And, you know, it was one of those moments, too, when you were, you know, you were so, so glad to see thoughtful responses to that question, but also just, I don't know, there was a little part of me that died inside that you have to apologize for being passionate.
Well, you know, I think Andrew Yang sort of set the tone on the books, right? Because he was the first one to answer, and he talked about his book, and it was funny, and Buttigieg picked up on that. But yeah, I love questions like this because they're so unexpected, and there are no talking points for it, you know.
It was
so
clearly very unexpected to Andrew Yang.
Yeah, well, I think all of them, and I think whoever goes first really is on the hot seat, but because the others have a chance to think about it a little bit. But you know, I thought that was a strong moment though for both Klobuchar and for Elizabeth Warren, because it was human. You know, I think with the men, as you know, as Jennifer pointed out, they were, you know, they're hawking something, you know, that was like promoting themselves basically. And the women were more, you know, introspective, more human, more empathetic, which is, you know, frankly, what we come to expect from women more than men. And it's also, I think, an echo of what Barack Obama was saying and was quoted as saying by one of the moderators, that, you know, the world would be better off in a lot of ways if more women were in charge.
But, you know, Jennifer Medina, yes, go ahead.
I think the reaction also might have split along gender lines, just based on what I was hearing and in comments afterwards. I think women like you sort of felt a little bit embarrassed for them, or, you know, felt a little bit cringeworthy.
Not so much that. It was just more like I was hoping we'd made some progress after Hillary's run on, you know, understanding the standards we set for women.
Yeah, I think that women found the answers a little bit more disappointing, maybe, than men did.
Hmm. Rorschach test.
Well, let me go next to Bonnie in San Francisco. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. So I just wanted to go back to the conversation on fundraising, because I think it really shows there was something missed in the conversation, and that is that the problem with fundraising with big billionaires right now is because the Democrats are picking a candidate. So, again, to me, this shows Pete Buttigieg's policy light, that he's a policy lightweight, because we're not talking about can you raise money for the general election. We're talking about, because I think all Democrats are going to get behind our candidate or we're going to work to do that. But what Warren was saying is that, you know, there was some kind of understanding that the Democrats were going to, you know, this is the primary, the time for this. It's an incredible election with so much import. You know, let's let people decide instead of going and, you know, behind closed doors in caves and raising a lot of money for the primary. That's the issue.
Well, saying,
let's let people in the Democratic Party decide who should run against Trump in this very important election. So you guys were talking about, you know, Buttigieg had this glib response, which was, well, you know, if we're going to beat Donald Trump, well, that's not the issue, Pete. The issue is, who do the Democrats want, not who do the billionaires and millionaires want. And it just shocks me that that people let him get off with these little clips. Like, well, in the healthcare debate, I also feel like, you know, who's funding him? We know he's getting funding. He's accepted funding from the PAC that's supported by insurers and big pharma.
Well,
so,
Bonnie, I really appreciate you registering your view on Buttigieg.
Yeah.
I do want to try to get just a couple more calls in here. I'm going to go next to Jeff in Larkspur. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. Good morning. I think the elephant in the room that sort of puts a dampener on all the comments by Bernie or for Elizabeth Warren and all the promises they want to make and problems they want to solve is we have $24 trillion in debt. And until somebody actually addresses that, there is no room for health care for all. There is no room for really anything that they're discussing. And no one is really talking about that. As far as the candidates, I thought Klobuchar was resonated best with me. And I thought what Yang said about not focusing on beating Donald Trump, but why did Donald Trump win, was really point, spot on.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks for sharing that as well. I'm going to try to get Imran in Stockton in. Hi, Imran.
Hello. Yes, I was thinking about, you know, he wasn't on the stage, Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. And even though he's rich and everything, but also I think he's the best electable that the Democrats could ever get, besides everybody on the stage.
So, well, electability is important to you, Imran.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also a moderate. And then he's also in line with the moderate Democrats of today. So he's also an outsider, too. So I'm seeing that could be a change of game, like how the Trump and his cronies did when they were going after Hillary Clinton, and they got it because he did not have that much money when he raised money. But the thing was, he did it all and then won the election. Even though 2016, there was some problems with the elections.
Yeah. Well, you know, Imran, I want to talk a little bit more about Bloomberg quickly, Scott Schaefer, which is that he did get the endorsements of two popular mayors in the Bay Area, Sam Liccardo of San Jose and Michael Tubbs of Stockton.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, in part because he has been working on issues that local officials care about, whether it's the soda tax or, you know, banning Juul for people under the age of 21.
And contributing a lot of money.
And contributing a lot of money to those campaigns. Absolutely. So I think that does speak to that. But, you know, I think, Mina, if you take a step back and listen to this whole hour and all the passion, both on the stage last night and also among voters for their candidates that they support, we have a real chance of going into the convention in Milwaukee in July without a nominee, without anybody who's gotten enough delegates to win, and the prospect of a brokered convention. And I think that's what maybe somebody like a Michael Bloomberg is counting on, that he can come in by spending a lot of money in big states like California, Texas, come into the convention with enough delegates to be a power broker, maybe to have some influence on who the nominee is, even if it isn't him. We haven't had one of those in a very long time. And so it could be interesting. It could also be very alienating for a lot of voters who feel that, we're back to the smoke-filled room kind of situation.
Well, John writes, Tom Steyer is correct, as was Jay Inslee, that the top three issues are global warming, climate crisis, and climate chaos. If you address this issue, you are the leader. Sophia writes, with fewer candidates on the stage, Amy Klobuchar was able to demonstrate her sharp intellect and articulateness that easily match Pete Buttigieg's. Her legislative record and policy position speak for themselves. Pete was wise to point out that women have a harder row than men. Jenny tweets, he wasn't on stage, but Julian Castro was on Skid Row in L.A. engaging with people about the tough issues they face around housing. I missed him last night. Well, Jennifer Medina, give me your sense of who left with some wind at their backs and what is going to happen the next month or so before we get into Iowa.
Well, we're going to have fewer people on next month's debate stage, and you're probably going to see the top four in Amy Klobuchar, and that's probably it. And I would say all five of them left with some wind behind at their back, some more than others. And perhaps Pete, because he had the most attacks, and Amy, because she landed the most attacks.
Well, Jennifer Medina, national political correspondent for The New York Times, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
And also Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of Political Breakdown. Thanks, Scott, for your analysis as well.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our listeners for sharing their reactions, who excited them, what issues they wanted to discuss. And wow, 2020, here we come. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.